In the 1730s, a group of 12 European adventurer scientists spent years in South America, scaling volcanoes and traversing jungles before they achieved their goal of establishing the exact shape of the Earth by measuring the length of 1 degree latitude at the equator. Their discovery opened up the possibility for safe, accurate navigation across the seas and enabled the accurate accounting of future expeditions. Joining us today to tell us about that expedition is Nicholas Crane. He's a geographer, explorer, and author of many books, but his latest is Latitude, the true story of the world's first scientific expedition. Mr. Crane speaking to us from Great Britain. Mr. Crane, thank you very much for being with us today. Why call this the world's first scientific expedition?
Well, there are several reasons, Scott. This was a large group of scientists setting off into the interior of what the Europeans was known as the New World. The core of the expedition was made up from members from two different nations, Spain and France, and then the British provided the scientific instruments. And then the results of that expedition were published back home in journals, in reports, and in maps. And for those reasons, you can really call this the beginning of international scientific expeditions.
So what was their goal? What did they want to do?
Their primary goal was to measure the length of 1 degree of latitude at the equator so that they could compare that result with the length of 1 degree of latitude far north in the northern hemisphere. And by comparing those two figures, they'd work out whether Earth was shaped like an egg or a pumpkin. They knew that Earth wasn't completely spherical, wasn't purely spherical, and it mattered to know the curvature of the Earth, so, because they needed to make accurate sea charts and land maps. And also, this was the height of that incredible era known as the Enlightenment, when a movement motivated by reason rather than faith. So empirical evidence mattered enormously, and there was great curiosity about the shape of the Earth.
Yeah, you know, that just wanted to follow up on that a little bit. You know, the story we were taught in elementary school was that before Columbus, many thought the Earth was flat and that explorers would just sail right over the edge. 240 years later, we knew that the Earth was round in some form, maybe not totally a circle. How did scientists know it in the 1730s that the Earth was, obviously they knew it wasn't flat, but that it had some circular shape to it?
Well, empirically, they discovered through trial and error that the Earth was not flat, that it was spherical, when Magellan, this incredible navigator from Spain, managed to sail a mountain expedition in 1520 and sail all the way around the world. He, of course, got killed during that voyage, but the survivors, led by a man, incredible Basque sailor called Elcano, came back to northern Spain. Having set off in one direction, they came back in the other, so they knew that the Earth was spherical. That was the 1520s, so that was the world's first circumnavigation. But they had worked it out, hypothetically, and indeed, in the 1730s, they knew through mathematics that Earth wasn't purely spherical, but there's a huge debate. Isaac Newton in England, was absolutely convinced that Earth was oblate, that it bulged at its midriff, that it was pumpkin shape, whereas followers in France of René Descartes had established, he thought, through measurements, actual measurements rather than theory, that Earth was actually egg-shaped, that it was pointed towards the poles. So these two titans of the Enlightenment were at war, effectively. And it generated a kind of brain race between the French and the British. The French were slightly envious that the British had established their Royal Academy in London in 1660. The French set up their Academy of Sciences 6 years later in 1666. And then you had the kind of, you know, the brain personnel, the brain race was on. The intellectuals were at war across the English Channel to prove whether Earth was actually oblate or prolate, whether it bulged at the equator or was pointed towards the poles.
You mentioned the instruments that were used. I mean, now today, 240 years later, or excuse me, almost 300 years later, this is something that, I don't know, a lot of those instruments probably are still used in some form or some, you know, they've been updated, but the way they measured latitude was unique. How did they go about it?
Such a good question. I'm rather fascinated by scientific instruments, so I delve into that in my book. But one of the instruments they relied on a lot, the compass, we'd all recognise today. You know, it's got this small metal needle at one end of which points towards magnetic north, wherever you are in the world. And so the compass is almost unchanged over those 240 years, as you say. But their main device for measuring the chain of triangles, as it was, on the ground, was a device known as a quadrant, which is a very heavy, had a cast iron base. It came in different sizes, so there were some of the quadrants were more portable than others, but essentially they had to carry these things up to the top of volcanoes on the equator to conduct their measurements. The other instrument, if I was to isolate two main instruments, the one on the ground was the quadrant. They used that initially to do the survey on the ground. But having gathered their ground measurements, they then had to take a series of astronomical measurements to fix the two ends of their survey line. And for that, they used a device known as a zenith sector, which was a complete nightmare, frankly. You know, it was enormous. One of them was over 15 foot long. You had to build an astronomical observatory to house it in. It was fantastically sensitive. So it was sensitive to heat and cold. There were earthquakes and so on. And it was a very difficult instrument to build. They were gone for so long that their instrument maker frequently had to mend the instruments they were using or devise modifications for them.
Yeah, it was like almost a decade that they were in South America with this. And what you describe, I mean, these are not flat fields or flat ground that they're doing this on. This is in the Andes Mountains of South America. It was difficult and it was dangerous. And it was just, it's from what you describe in the book, it's incredible that they were able to achieve what they did.
Yes, I'm only laughing because when I was researching this book, I researched it during the depths of the what in the UK was the lockdowns during the pandemic. And so I was able to travel virtually to the Ecuadorian Andes that I'd been to in real life many decades ago when I was young. So I knew what they looked like. And you're absolutely right, Scott. It was an absolute nightmare. I mean, these were Europeans who had never been to South America before. And some of them, in fact, most of them were from the flatlands of France. And so they were trying to operate to conduct a survey amid snow-capped, ice-covered live volcanoes, equatorial rainforest. I mean, the rivers were actually one of the most difficult things of all, because of course the Inca civilization that had populated that part of South America 200 years before the expedition arrived there never really did get round to building what we in Europe would have known as solid bridges. You know, the ravines, the torrents, the rivers, they were all crossed by these swinging rope bridges, which completely terrified the Europeans when they first saw them. And many of the rivers weren't even bridged, so they had to ride their horses through the rivers. And I've done a fair bit of difficult expedition work myself, and rivers are frequently the most dangerous things you encounter. It's not so much the altitude, the ice, the snow, the cold, the storms, you can generally sort of navigate around those, but rivers can take you away very quickly.
Well, I mean, they even, when you think about this, yes, the mountains, the rivers, they were all challenges, but even fog, even rain, even just a cloudy day or a cloudy night, especially when you couldn't see the nighttime sky, all those presented challenges to them as well. Now, while this expedition was underway, another one was sent out in the Northern Hemisphere. The idea was to have latitude for the two extreme points. What did that find? And what was accomplished with finding latitude at the equator and then in the Northern Hemisphere?
Yes, there was a if you like, a competing expedition that set sail for the Baltic Sea without the knowledge of the Equatorial Expedition. They didn't find out till after a year after this Northern Expedition had set off, but the French Academy in Paris sent this other expedition north of the Arctic Circle. So they sailed out the Baltic Sea, then they conducted a survey on land to measure the length of 1 degree of latitude, so that they could compare that with the length of 1 degree of latitude at the equator that was being measured by this expedition I've written about. So the risk was to the Equatorial Expedition that the Arctic Expedition would get back first with their measurement and make their own equatorial readings completely redundant. In fact, what happened was that the Arctic Expedition measured just 1 degree of latitude. And when they came back, it kind of showed that the Earth was indeed, as Newton had said, that it was oblate, that it was bulging at its midriff, that it was pumpkin shaped. But the thing is that the Equatorial Expedition measured 3 degrees of latitude, so they could come back with a much more accurate figure. So that if we're talking about definitive science, it was the Equatorial Expedition that came home with the booty.
So how did this expedition advance science? And what were the practical applications afterwards?
Well, in a way, Scott, my conclusion was that the findings about the length of 1 degree of latitude were immensely helpful, that it did indeed help with creating navigational charts and so on. But that actually it was the peripheral discoveries that made a bigger difference. So the expedition did great work, for example, on quinine, which was the only known cure for malaria. They came home with the first European description of rubber. They came across platinum. They did experiments on gravity, on magnetism, on the aberration of light. They measured the speed of sound at altitude. And interestingly, they conducted the first measured survey of a major Inca archaeological site. And they also did great work researching human rights abuses in colonial South America. So I would say it was those peripheral advances that added up to more than the latitude findings.
I have to say that when you were describing those peripheral discoveries and findings, it sounded much like the description of the space program in the 1960s and 1970s, the things that we found by exploring space. We only have a couple minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Where does this expedition fall in world history as far as an accomplishment?
It's the beginning of international scientific collaboration. And right now, we're just a few days from the UN Climate Conference in Glasgow, which is one of the most important international scientific collaborations ever in the history of the planet. And of course, we're trying to deal globally through international collaboration with a global pandemic. So this story, this latitude story, the world's first international scientific expedition, is the beginning of those processes, international scientific collaboration.
You know, one thing I have to say that, since we only have a minute or so left, one thing that your book really kind of surprised me with was how advanced, or I don't know whether advanced is the word, but that the Spanish had already set up a fairly robust series of communities in South America for that time.
Yes, they had. And the Spanish colony in America was very corrupt. But there wasn't infrastructure. So the scientists were able to plug into that existing infrastructure. And that was very helpful for them in terms of getting about, moving between the different locations they had to. But they also ran foul of it. So that, you know, one of their number, their surgeon, was murdered through an altercation with one of the old Spanish families in South America. And another of the members of the expedition died through disease. Disease was a constant problem for them. So there were, you know, it was both a colonized part of the world, Spanish South America, but it's also one that was relatively lawless. And, this was a team mainly made up of Frenchmen in a Spanish colony. So they had, the odds were stacked against them in terms of progress, which is why they took along two Spanish naval lieutenants who actually smoothed their progress through the Andes.
Nicholas Crane, I hate to interrupt you, but I'm going to have to. I ran out of time. The book is Latitude, the True Story of the World's First Scientific Expedition. Mr. Crane, thank you very much for being with us today.